The scripture this morning is from 1 Corinthians 11, 17 through 34. It's a letter that Paul has written to an unruly and headstrong church. Now in the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. To begin with, when you come together as a gathered church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and to some extent I believe it. For when you come together in one place, it is not really to eat a supper of the Lord. For when it comes to the meal, some eat their own suppers first, and one goes hungry, and another is drunk. What? Do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? Or do you show contempt for the gathered church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What should I say to you? In this matter, I do not commend you. For I received from the Lord what I also handed on to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body that is for you. Do this to remember me." In the same way, he took the cup also after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink to remember me." For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats the bread and drinks the cup in an unworthy manner will be answerable for the body and blood of the Lord. Examine yourselves, and only then eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For all who eat and drink without discerning the body eat and drink judgment against themselves. For this reason, some of you are weak and ill, and some have died. So then, my brothers and sisters, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If any are hungry, let them eat in the house church, so that when you come together, it will not be for your condemnation.
I'm here to introduce our guest speaker this morning, and as a prayer to begin her sermon, I invite you to turn to the front of the bulletin, and we'll be reading the reflections on our table display that Christy Baker put together, and Christy Baker wrote these reflections. We'll be reading it as a prayer at the end of this introduction to introduce Rita's sermon. We're very honored this morning to have Rita Haldeman Finger with us. My heart sank a little bit this week as I kept getting emails from people in church who were saying either they're sick or need to go out of town, and I'll just tell one of those stories that relates directly to the sermon. Are not here this morning. They're hosting a colleague from work in their home who's just come out of the hospital from surgery and doesn't have family. So they, this morning, sat around the table with a colleague from their work who couldn't take care of herself at home and shared breakfast with her and cared for her and was with her during this time. So they are walking with her today and trying to be with her in the midst of her being a broken vessel physically at this time. Rita Haldeman comes to us as a recently retired professor of New Testament at Messiah College. She has a number of fascinating books exploring the early church life, one of which is exploring house churches in early Rome. Her most recent book is Of Widows and Meals, Communal Meals in the Book of Acts, which explores how the church, the early church, experienced communal meals. I invite us to hear her words in her sermon to us this morning. We've already heard her in a Sunday school class and been challenged to see some of the understandings of Acts in new ways. Rita comes to us from Community Mennonite Church in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and she comes to us from a rich and long tradition of working and serving in many church circles. Rita, may you receive this prayer as we read together these words to empower your preaching for us this morning. I invite us to read these words acknowledging this is how we come to the table of the Lord. Let's read together. Empty bowls, cracked and clattering, unbalanced upon the table's surface, into your home, our home, we gather. Mismatched vessels, in pride, in shame, in humility, each one hungry, each one desperate for your presence. Our host, our guest, our servant Lord, clean us, hold us, fill us. Blessings, Rita.
Yeah, I'd like to say that it's an honor to be with you today. I haven't ever been here before at your church, and so I'm happy to be here. Can somebody help me? When did this church get started? What? 1958. Oh, I didn't even think of looking. Okay, so it's over 50 years. Wow, that's impressive. Well, anyway, Roy told me that your theme for January is Light at the Table. I was familiar with working on the table part, but not so much on the light part. And so I just had never thought of connecting meals with light. But I came to think that it actually works pretty well. For one thing, the Isaiah 58 text that was already read already made that connection. You share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house, then your light will rise in the darkness and your gloom will be like the noonday. Sounds like a house. Your house will be pretty well lit up with all those people. Many of us can probably connect light at the table with a romantic or celebratory meal where we eat by candlelight. And that reminded me that in the ancient world of the early church, their celebration of the Lord's Supper would have taken place after the sunset and by the light of little oil lamps. I have here an example of one of these little lamps. You can't imagine they would have made much light. You pour the oil in the hole at the top and you light the wick and that's it. So probably just enough light to cut the bread and the fish and to see each other a little bit across the circle. In the New Testament, only one text connects a meal with these lamps, and that is in Acts 20, 7 through 12. Here we have the Apostle Paul visiting a church in Troas, which is a large city, was a large city, now in Turkey. And they met to break bread in verse 7. And then Paul talked until midnight. So it was quite a long meeting since he talked that late, since he was leaving the next day. Now, verse 8 in this text throws in something which seems extraneous. Luke says, "There were many lamps in the room upstairs where we were meeting." Why does Luke include the lamps? Probably because more of them were lit than usual for this apparently special occasion. The rest of that account talks about Eutychus, the boy who went to sleep and fell out of the window and was taken up for dead, and then Paul revived him. So what I now conclude is that all that smoky pollution from those extra lamps have knocked the poor boy out. Why else would Luke have included the note about many lamps? I don't know. Well, before we move on to this main text in 1 Corinthians 11, which was read, I'd like to comment just a bit more about those Lucan readings that you heard about Jesus' meal practices. There are three things I'd like you to remember. First, it's not hard to see that Jesus had some pretty inclusive meal practices. He seemed especially fond of people that respectable people didn't like to eat with. Second, I wonder if you noted the repetition in several of these stories. When Jesus was the host of a meal, he, and this is what it says several times, he took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to the rest of the people who were there. This was apparently such a common practice of Jesus that the couple who was walking on the road with him on the way to Emmaus didn't recognize him until he followed that familiar practice of taking bread, blessing it, breaking it, and distributing it. We'll see a little bit more about that later on. And the third thing about these Lucan texts is, since Luke also wrote the book of Acts, he wants to show how Jesus' meal practices were carried on in the Pentecost community in Jerusalem. And as I explained in Sunday school, Luke shows that the sharing of possessions and the daily meals was a fulfillment of the table fellowship that Jesus had begun. And as we shall see in Corinth a little bit later, this practice of a sacred daily communal meal became an identifying mark of the early church as it spread throughout the Greco-Roman world. But for a moment, let's go behind the text into the ancient world where the Lord's Supper originated. Here, at least 90% of people lived at or below subsistence, just barely getting by, if that. Here, having enough food was life itself. Here in the Roman Empire, crops are heavily taxed to subsidize the wealthy 2 to 3, 4% at the top. Here in Palestine, peasants are gradually losing their land to debt and becoming sharecroppers who get to keep only 1/3 to 1/2 of the crops they raise. Getting enough calories to survive and raise children was an ongoing struggle. Surely the constant prayer of peasants would have been, "Give us this day our daily bread. Without food, you die." And we, by the way, are seeing this in living technicolor on our TV screens right now with the desperate situation in Haiti, where they say, if you can't get food and water to these people, many more will die. So we know that this is not just an ancient crisis. Back to ancient culture. Food was not only life-giving, but it symbolized hospitality and community. You do not eat supper alone. You eat it with your household, your kinfolk. And when you risk inviting strangers, they no longer remain strangers, but friends. If you end up eating with an enemy, that is your unspoken commitment that you will never kill each other. To eat a meal together is to make peace and to sustain social life as well as physical life. Now, I'm going to give you a chance to talk. I feel like I've been talking a lot today, so I'm going to give you a chance to talk. And here's what I'd like you to do, if you don't mind. In a minute, I'd like you to stand up, and I want you to find one or two other people that around you that you're not related to and that you don't live with. And I want you to talk about two questions, okay? See if you can remember this. First of all, what is your favorite food, and whom do you usually eat it with? Okay, what is your favorite food, and who do you usually eat with? And the second one, when have you last eaten with someone who is not from your social class, either up or down? When did you last eat with somebody not from your own social class? So let's just take a couple minutes right now. Stand up and see if you can find one or two other people that you're not related to and you don't live with. What's your favorite food? Who do you eat it with? If we can come back together. All right, thank you very much. I guess nobody had a problem talking about food, our second most favorite topic to talk about, right? Okay, now, for the rest of my time, I want to examine with you the very earliest text we have concerning the Lord's Supper. This one that was read, 1 Corinthians 11, 17 to 34. The most, and you want to, you probably want to get that out and look at it, because we're going to be looking at it somewhat carefully, doing exegesis, if you know what that means. The most common meaning that we give to this text, while we mainly focus on verses 23 to 26, for example, the most common meaning we give to this text is this concerns our relationship with God. When we take communion, we as individuals need to be right with God and to solemnly reflect on Jesus' substitutionary atonement or death for each of us. It's a vertical relationship. I'm going to assert here that that is not Paul's main issue here at all. Paul's real concern is with social relationships, horizontal relationships, especially those that cut across class and probably race. But now we need some context for the church in Corinth. Corinth was a seaport, very cosmopolitan city, and according to chapter 1 of this letter of Paul's, the believers were splitting apart. They were not getting along any better than the religious left and the religious right is getting along today. There was a Catholic church and a Pentecostal church and a Baptist church and an independent church and who knows, maybe even an Anabaptist church. But, and furthermore, these splits seem to be along class lines. In chapter 1, verse 26, Paul says, "Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many of noble birth." So we can assume that a majority of believers are in the lower subsistence classes who tend to be looked down on by the wealthy, more educated people. At the same time, a few church members are richer and more powerful. We know of Chloe and Stephanus in chapter 1, who are heads of households. It looks like a few people are wealthy enough to own a house in which a group of believers meet. The rest of the people do not live in a house. They may share the rent with another family in a one-room apartment, maybe with a curtain between them or something, on the fourth floor of a tumble-down tenement. Or they may be slaves who sleep in the kitchen or out in the courtyard. In the crowded cities of the Roman Empire, there was a ratio of at least 10 blocks of tenements, these 4 to 5 story crumbling, falling down tenements, maybe sort of like what fell in the earthquake in Haiti. Anyway, 10 blocks of these to about one freestanding house. So if there were two or three people in the entire collection of Corinthian believers who had a house or a larger apartment in which they met, that was saying something. Now, looking at this letter itself, the letter of 1 Corinthians, we can see that in chapters 11 through 14, Paul has a worship service in mind. This service would have typically been held each evening after the day's work. It followed typical Greco-Roman custom. It would begin with this ritual of bread breaking. Pagans broke bread in honor of a god or a goddess in whose name they were meeting, and Christians broke bread to honor the risen Jesus. Then they would eat the meal. At the end of the meal, drinks would be mixed. Water with the wine. They always mixed water with the wine, and the first drink then would be poured out as a libation to the god, whichever one it was. And then came the evening's entertainment. Sober pagans discussed philosophy, and so they mixed a lot of water with their wine, and the rowdy ones mixed very little water with their wine so they could get drunk and call in the slave call girls and have a good time. The Christians presumably worship God using their spiritual gifts, as what we have in these chapters, which is why Paul tries to control some of that exuberance in chapter 14. Maybe those Corinthians didn't mix enough water with their wine either. But now, let's return to the meal, beginning in 11:17. We can see at a glance that Paul is not happy. The divisions he talked about earlier are visible right at supper time, and things are worse than if they didn't even meet at all, verse 17. Some people get together earlier and eat the good food, and when the others come later, there's not much left, verse 21. This, says Paul, is not a supper of the Lord. It's not the kind of meal Jesus ate. You're just eating your own suppers. What upsets Paul here is a class issue. And here he seems to be speaking to the upper class members of this church. Rich people in the Roman Empire did not need to work. They drew their income from rents or the produce from their estates, which were by slaves. So they could begin their suppers. In the afternoon they'd go to the baths, and then they'd come back, and in the late afternoon they'd have their suppers together, invite their friends, recline on couches, and have slaves serve them. That was their typical day. But for these meals, when the craftspeople and the shopkeepers and the peasants and the slaves who do manual labor all day, they can't do that. They have to work until the sun sets and they can't see anymore. Then they come, and by the time they arrive for worship, only crumbs are left. Looking at the text, now we can see how eating together is the critical issue. The same Greek word, and that word is synergomai, you don't have to remember it, but it means to come together, and it's used five times. In verses 17, and I've italicized them so you can see them easier, verse 18, 20, 23, I'm sorry, 20, 33, and 34. Plus, Paul uses two other terms to refer to being together. In verse 18, he uses the term ecclesia, which means the gathered church. We get our word ecclesiastical from that. That means coming together. And then in verse 20, he uses a particular Greek phrase called epi ta auta, which means together in one place, and that's the way I have it translated there. So Paul sees a supper of the Lord as characterized by eating together all at the same time, rich and poor sitting down next to each other. If people are not eating together and everyone has enough, it's not a Jesus supper. We always associate the term Lord's Supper with bread and wine or grape juice at communion. But this is the only time this term is used in the New Testament. And it's not called the Lord's Supper. It's a Lord's Supper. It's a Jesus-like supper. So what Paul has in mind here goes beyond just the Last Supper of Jesus had to all the other meals that he ate with poor, smelly, ritually unclean, outcast people during his lifetime that you just heard about. Jesus' inclusive, boundary-breaking meals are what Paul refers to when he says in verses 20 to 22, unless everybody eats together and has enough to eat, you are not eating a Jesus kind of meal. You are showing contempt for the gathered church of God, and you humiliate those who are, and this is literally in Greek, the have-nots. In the ancient world, the value of honor was extremely high, and to humiliate, to shame somebody was the opposite of that, and a very bad thing to do. And that's what Paul is accusing the wealthier people of doing. But here's the problem now. What do we do with verses 22 and 34? Which refer to the house or home. The NIV and the NRSV, I don't know which you have, but probably one or the other, says in verse 22, either one of them says, do you not have homes to eat and drink in? And in verse 34, these translations, the same translations say, if you are hungry, eat at home. Now, these texts have always been interpreted to mean that the Lord's Supper is just a symbol and not a real meal to fill up on. One should eat up at home before you come to church so you don't pig out there. But that is the opposite of Paul's point. And, of course, it all also presupposes that everybody in the ancient world had a house with full refrigerators like we do. So the word house here must mean house church, because only a few wealthy people actually had a house to begin with where people could come and eat. The place to eat up should be the house church. This is the only way where people who have nothing get enough to eat. Well, now let's look at verses 23 to 26. This is the part that often gets read in communion, part we're most familiar with. Paul does set this ritual in the context of Jesus' last Passover meal. He says he received this account from the Lord, meaning that he heard it from apostles like John or Peter, who heard it directly from Jesus on that night. Jesus takes bread at the beginning of the meal, breaks it, and then he says, this is my body which is for you. Do this to remember me. Now, there are two peculiar things about this quote. First, the words broken for are not included in the best Greek manuscripts. This is my body broken for you. It's this is my body which is for you. So Jesus may not be referring to his crucifixion. Second, Jesus says, do this instead of what we would think would be the logical thing, be eat this. So I would suggest that Jesus is using the word body in two ways, his own physical life and his body, the group of disciples gathered around him. So when he says, do this, he means do this together. Eat this bread together and remember me and my practice of inclusive table fellowship with all the people of Israel. Then, in verse 25, the cup comes after supper, and again Jesus says, do this instead of drink this. The doing is sharing the cup, not simply drinking your share. The new covenant is not a contract between the individual and God. It's God's covenant with the people of God as a whole. Now, I don't know if this is true, but I suspect that since Jesus did not succeed in cleansing the corrupt temple system at the beginning of that week, he was rejecting the whole system and offering himself and his inclusive table fellowship as the way in which God's covenant would be renewed. Paul tells the Corinthians in verse 26 to proclaim the death of the Lord. I don't believe this is, in this context, it means a substitutionary atonement. I think it means an act of self-giving. as Jesus risked his life for his people by his table practices and his symbolic destruction of the temple system that cheated people out of their food, so wealthy Corinthian believers should share themselves and their food with those in need, regardless of the cost. So, when we look at the communal nature of this ritual in verses 23 to 26, now we can understand the last section, 27 to 34. How does one eat the bread or drink the cup of Jesus unworthily? This verse has prevented many people of tender consciences from taking communion if they felt guilty about something. Or it's used as a club by church leaders to keep their people in line. And I can't help but remember the other year when I was eating with a group of students, and one of the young men, Keith, was telling his story about how all through junior high and high school, he never took communion because he was terrified that he would be somehow taking it unworthily. So I said, Keith, I have some good news for you, which is what I'm speaking about right now. When we understand that Paul's use of the word body has a double meaning, then the text begins to make sense. Verse 29. All who eat and drink without discerning the body, the whole church gathered together, eat and drink judgment against themselves. The rich who ignore the poor and their needs for food are the ones ultimately eating judgment upon themselves. Paul goes on to say, this is why many of you in your church are weak and ill, and some even have died. When people don't get enough calories, they get sick and some die. Though it looks on the surface as if the rich, selfish people who are in the wrong will get sick and die, I think Paul is thinking corporately here, not individually. If the body of Christ as a whole does not act like Jesus did at his meals, some will suffer. Further evidence for Paul's use of the word body to mean the whole church here can be seen in chapter 12, which comes, of course, right after this. Here, Paul specifically compares the physical body to the church as a body. And as a representative, I included on the second side of the handout verse 12 from that chapter, and I'd like us to read that together. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in the one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and we were all made to drink of one Spirit. Now comes the challenging part. It's one thing to figure out what a text would have meant to the original audience. That's an essential first step. We always have to figure out what it meant before we can figure out what it means today, or we'll get it wrong. But because we live in such a different culture and time, we have to be pretty creative about how we take seriously what Paul says here. In the book that I wrote that Roy mentioned, of Widows and Meals, I have a range of things at the end of the book of what churches and Christian groups, how they are eating together today and so forth. Some of you know about the little grill in the early church up in Harrisonburg. They're the most, the closest concrete example that I'm aware of people that are really trying to do that. But I'm going to make, instead of giving other examples, I'm just going to make a few more general suggestions of what I think churches could at least begin to do. First, when we have communion, I'd like to see a wider range of meanings proclaimed or preached in that context. We have centuries of tradition where communion has meant one thing. It's our vertical relationship to God, and we solemnly reflect on Jesus' atonement, or death for us. I would like to see these broader, very biblical meanings included at different times. Eating food together is a powerful symbol of unity, and there are many meanings we can draw from it, even when we do only eat and drink tiny little bits of food. Second, if we do see these little bits of food as a symbol of an entire meal, I think that churches should have more women serving communion to symbolize the fact that women generally have been the main people preparing and serving meals. And I know I'm sure this isn't a problem here, but it's always been somewhat ironic to me that in some churches, you have only men being allowed to serve the Lord's Supper upstairs in the sanctuary, while at the same time downstairs you have women preparing the potluck meal. A meal which probably could be more accurately called a Jesus Supper than the one upstairs. And like I said, this is probably not an issue here at all with you. I'm preaching to the choir, but the problem is it's only the choir that ever invites me to come and say these things. Nobody who thinks that women shouldn't do this would ever invite me to come. Tell them that. Third, I think we could also pour more theological meaning into those potluck meals that we have and see them as shared Jesus meals that we eat together. We might sometimes have a bread-breaking ceremony at the beginning to remind us of the presence of the risen Jesus at the meal. Such meals can also be a place where we invite other people to a Jesus meal and be less concerned about who's in and who's out, who can and who can't take communion. And that leads me to my fourth and last point, that we can use food and eating together as a way to draw in people who are not like us, who may not believe the same things that we do, and who have different lifestyles, people of different classes or races. I think breaking down class barriers is the hardest thing of all, and that maybe with some people, food is the only thing you have in common. How often do we eat with people outside of our comfort zone? Not very often. Even though Jesus says that, well, even sinners eat with their friends. Sometimes I like to think of the church body as a circle where the outsider edges of the circle are porous. We can invite people in to eat with us, even though they may not have the same commitment that we do. But as we and they do come in and move toward the center, we have to realize the demands are quite high. We're called to share everything we have. We cannot remain like the rich Christians of Corinth who had nice, cozy suppers with people of their own class before the riffraff came. To truly eat a Jesus supper, a Lord's supper, we have to figure out how to eat and share life together.